Central Time. I'm Rob Ferry. Now, if you're looking to add some variety to your baking, try using farro flour, maybe einkorn berries, or another heritage grain. Our next guest works with a variety of grains, growing them, milling, and cooking with them. She says using different grains can add great flavor and texture, give options for people with special dietary needs, including gluten-free options, and they can help the environment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gone against the grain with your cooking, using stuff apart from the typical all-purpose white and wheat flours? Do you use barley, farro, oats, durum, you name it? Have you found heritage grains accessible maybe in your local stores or markets? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Emma Zimmerman is the author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains. She's officially been experimenting with milling grains since 2011 with her dad. Emma, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about these grains.
What got you and your dad into this wide variety of grains and flours and growing them and milling them in the first place?
Yeah, so we're in Phoenix, Arizona, and there is a heritage grain that's been in this region for a while called White Sonora Wheat. And that was kind of our first foray into this whole world of heritage grains. And we started growing it. We grew 10 acres with a local farmer. Loved it. Got some excitement from chefs and local bakers. And that just kind of led to like discovering this whole world of grains that had been forgotten. And we're kind of, you know, just sitting in seed banks, not getting eaten or enjoyed.
So it sounds like fun growing it and milling it and all. But for maybe that home cook who's listening right now, if they asked, what's in it for me? What would you tell them about opening up their eyes to some of this variety?
Well, I could, you know, go on about like health benefits of whole grains and all that stuff. I love like getting people excited about the flavors and kind of like I always compare it to maybe coloring with, the 64 pack of crayons. Like you just have a lot more options and a lot more, that you can do with your creativity in the kitchen, having flour that's not just sort of like a white inert substance that doesn't quite offer anything. You know, it becomes more of a central player in your kitchen, which is really fun. The book, The Miller's Daughter, has 10 different grains and legumes. And there's just so many different ways that you can prepare these grains as well. So it's even beyond baking. If people aren't considering themselves bakers, there's something for everyone.
Well, let's check out one of the grains now. And I've used this. I don't actually know what it is. I don't even know if I'm saying it right. Farro, F-A-R-R-O. Is that right? Farro or farro?
Yeah.
Farro.
Yes.
Okay,
you
great.
Can say either way, actually.
Excellent. Good. And then, like I said, I've cooked with it. I've eaten it. I don't actually know what it is. What is farro?
So farro is a very old grain. We call it an ancient grain because it's thousands of years old. It's sort of a precursor to what we know as modern wheat. Some people call it farro because it is the pharaoh's wheat. It's a very old variety that probably ancient Egyptians were eating. And it's a really nutty, deeply flavorful grain. Yeah, you can cook it whole like rice. So there's a bunch of salads in the book. It makes such a great salad. And you can mill it and turn it into flour. There's a farro banana bread that has some chocolate in it as well. And those are some of my favorite recipes. Farro is pretty accessible as well right now. I think most people listening could probably find it either just in their local supermarket or at a local mill near them. But it's pretty well established here. It's really popular in Italian cooking as well.
Now we've got that recipe. You shared it with us. It's up at WPR.org/Food Friday, the chocolate flecked farro banana bread. So what is having farro? Now this is like, it's not the whole farro, as you said, it's like a farro milled flour. What does that do? How does it make the banana bread different?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad that you have that recipe up. That's kind of my go-to when people ask like, where do we start, you know, with this book? Because everyone, you know, banana bread, like, pretty accessible. Everyone can make banana bread, I hope.
It's not too hard. Even I can do it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not too hard. And I mean, I always have overripe bananas on hand. It always seems I'm like a little too ambitious buying bananas every week. But farro flour is a great swap for that white flour. And it just, it's a great way to kind of taste the difference in adding a stone milled ancient grain flour into your baking. People always love that recipe. It's so fun to serve it to friends and family because it tastes familiar, but it just has that extra layer of something else. So it always kind of starts a conversation about these grains.
Talking to Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains, Stories and Recipes from Hayden Flour Mills. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you like to cook or bake with different kinds of grains and flours? What are your favorites? What have you experimented with? Do you have a question for our guest? Maybe you tried it and it didn't come out so good. Maybe Emma could help you out. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Emma, a lot of times we're going to buy flour already milled. What are options for getting something that's in, you know, a harder, chunkier form if we want to get something and grind it up at home? Are there some we can do that with?
Yes, there. You could get into home milling. It's not something that I've personally explored, seeing as I own a flour mill. I can just go get my flour
very
there.
Fair.
But yeah, there, you can home mill, anywhere, you know, from like a blender attachment to something like a little more substantial as a countertop mill or a hand mill. But that's, I mean, that's really the ultimate. And that's how we got started, honestly, is, my dad was baking bread and then he started milling his own flour to kind of, you know, enhance the fresh taste of his flour. And one thing led to the next and all of a sudden the mill, the home countertop mill, you know, got a little bit bigger and bigger and bigger until now we have a whole milling operation.
Mission creep for sure. Yeah. Let's check out some other grains. Now, barley, I just think of, you know, barley is barley and you go and buy a package with the word barley on it. There's different kinds of barley and you've got, I think, purple barley, for example. Can you tell us about some of the variety in the barley world?
Yeah. So there is bronze barleys. We grow a variety of Tibetan purple barley. It's just really fun. It is purple in the field. Like, so if you were, you know, flying overhead with a drone, you could actually see this lavender colored field. And then the seeds are very deep, rich purple. So just from, you know, from that, like, it's so fun to cook with. There's a recipe in the book that's a barley lemonade. And really pretty, like violet purple color, and ooh, it's very delicious and a refreshing. And that's always really fun to surprise people with. But yeah, barley, I think, has kind of that like barley stew reputation. And I tried to steer away from that and make barley a little more exciting. There's a lot of cuisines throughout the world that use barley as well, so a lot of inspiration there. But yeah, purple barley is the one that we grow and really love at the mill, even though there's a lot of different varieties. I mean, if your food can be more colorful, why not?
Well, here's the one that got me, because I grew up with my Polish grandma's pierogies. And you've got a purple potato pierogi using ideally this purple barley. Tell us about this one.
Yes. So I hope someone will make this recipe.
But I might.
It's a purple barley, dumpling and, you know, wrapper. And then the purple potato inside. So it's like purple on purple. I love cooking with color in mind. So anytime I can play with color and also make it delicious, I just can't resist. So that one was really fun to do. And yeah, like if you make bread with purple barley flour, that bread will have a lavender color. Like it's just really fun.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains. She's talking with us about how we can experiment in the kitchen with more than just that all-purpose, say, white flour by using a lot of different heritage grains, other kinds of flours. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you ever tried milling your own flour from, say, wheat berries or whatever before, how did it go? Do you use different kinds of flours in your cooking or baking, different kinds kinds of grains. If you are gluten-free for one reason or another, what kind of grains have you had success with where stuff comes out with great flavors and textures? Or do you have questions for our guest about what to do with all this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Remember, we got that banana bread made with Faro recipe. There's some chocolate in there, too. Find it at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains. After experimenting with growing and milling grains for more than a decade with her dad, Emma's with us to talk about using a lot of different types of grains and flours in our own cooking and baking. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences using different grains, maybe growing or milling them yourself, or your questions, 800-642-1234. Linda joins us in Milwaukee. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I happen to be Jewish, and, you know, we Jews have the holiday of Passover, and that lasts 8 days, and you were not allowed to eat any leavened products. Nothing with yeast, no leavening. And the reason for that is because when we had to leave Egypt, we had no time to let the bread rise. And so we have to be very ingenious, you know, because matzah is just flour and water. So I make something that's Persian. It's called a spinach mina. And what it is you wet matzah and you put it in an oiled or buttered or grease, whatever, 8-inch pan. I use glass. And then you layer in meat, cooked chopped meat. You can put almonds in it if you want to. And then I make about a 3-inch layer of that. And then you put another piece of wet matzah on top, and you pour a beaten egg over the whole thing and bake it.
Wow.
And it's absolutely delicious.
That sounds fantastic, Linda. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Emma, do you have favorite flours or grains that work well as a bread-like product that is unleavened, that's no yeast in the picture?
Yeah. Oh, that recipe sounded so
totally
good. Yes, there's a few cracker recipes in the book. That's with a type of wheat called Durum. It's a pasta wheat. We grow a heritage variety called Bluebeard Durum that has these blue awns on it, kind of creating this blue beard effect in the field. But that's a really delicious pasta wheat, and it also makes really great crackers because it gives that same kind of like firm crunch to it. A lot of the recipes in the book, I don't do a lot of bread kind of baking. There's a few things, but not a lot of yeast. So it's not, you know, when people hear about ancient and heritage grains, they think of those sourdough kind of European style loaves. But in this case, I really wanted to showcase all the other ways that you could use these grains. Maybe if sourdough is a little bit intimidating, or using yeast can be a little bit intimidating, but quick breads, crackers, whole grain salads, you know, waffles, pancakes, there's so many things that you can do with these grains. And in fact, it's almost better to keep things really simple. That way you can taste the actual flavor of the grain as you're baking.
Thanks a lot for that call, Linda, at 800-642-1234. Sharon joins us next in Appleton. Sharon, hi.
Hi, well, I'm gluten sensitive, not celiac, and I've used gluten-free grains for years. And I never buy gluten-free flours pre-mixed because they're just filled with potato starch and corn starch and no whole grains. So I keep about a dozen different gluten-free flours in my refrigerator almost any time. And I'll just take any recipe. I don't do yeasted things because that's too hard. But quick bread, cookies, pancakes, waffles, etc. If it says a cup of flour, I'll just grab maybe 3 different kinds of gluten-free flours, a third a cup of each, unless I'm using coconut. And then I use a little less because coconut soaks up the moisture just a lot. And then just start to play with how the different textures you get from the different flours.
Sharon, what are a couple of your rock star flours that you go to?
Sorghum. So sorghum and coconut if you want something really moist.
Excellent.
And then if you want something a little bit lighter, and I will go with rice or millet. You know, I put in, like for pancakes, I love buckwheat, a little buckwheat, but not straight.
Sharon, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for sharing all that with us. Emma, one thing that popped to my mind is you've got a whole chapter on chickpea flour in the book.
Yes. Yeah, so chickpea is also one of the gluten-free flours. There's a whole world. I mean, I cover 10 types of flours and grains, but there's, as Sharon mentioned, sorghum and buckwheat and so many other things you wouldn't typically think that you can turn into flour. Chickpeas are great because they're naturally gluten-free. They grow really well as a cover crop for wheat, so they're great to rotate in. And yeah, you can make such amazing things from chickpea flour. There's a chickpea flour pound cake in the book that I really love with this tahini glaze and a baharat spice. You can make chickpea fries. Those always go really fast. But yeah, it's a really fun flour to kind of play with, and a great option if you're trying to stay away from gluten. I will say that a lot of our customers who come to us because they are gluten sensitive and they find that they can eat these older varieties, these heritage grains, these ancient grains with no reaction. So that's really hopeful too. Another reason that we think these grains are worth growing.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Emma Zimmerman is with us on this week's edition of Food Friday. Her new cookbook is called The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains, Stories and Recipes from Hayden Flour Mills. Emma, let's talk about the grain that you mentioned earlier, started it all, that white Sonora flour. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, white Sonora wheat is the first wheat that came to North America. The legend is that it was brought over by Jesuit German missionaries, you know, bringing the foods from home. Also needed wheat flour to, you know, make the Eucharist. Yeah, so it's been here in the Southwest for 400 years. So it became acclimated, what we call became a land race. One of the reasons we love it is because of that story, and because it takes less water to grow, which is a huge thing for us here in Arizona. We need to take a lot of care with our water. So having a crop that's arid adapted is really great. And, you know, so probably something we need to do more of in the future. It tastes great. It's so beautiful. I actually got married 10 years ago, and that was my wedding bouquet because I thought it was just so beautiful. So
awesome. Now, you mentioned some of the environmental benefits there. Can you talk? That's something you talk about a little bit in the book, and we've been focusing on, you know, cooking with the stuff. But what are some more of the environmental benefits of checking out these wider varieties of ancient grains?
Yeah, they are really great, especially in conjunction with regenerative agriculture practices. They're really great for the soil. They demand less inputs, so they can be, you know, a lower cost to a farmer, and yeah, lower water. So yeah, that's all part of the story, you know, beyond just the flavor and kind of the excitement and the creativity that comes from using these grains. We also think they're kind of part of our future, and we need to go back and recover a lot of that biodiversity that we've lost in the industrial food system. And the best way to, you know, promote biodiversity in our food system is to eat these grains, and of course, to have really good recipes that inspire people to use them.
There's been some chatter among Central Time producers about what your farm and operation looks like. Can you kind of paint us a picture of what we would see if we were taking a tour?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, so Hayden Flour Mills is actually a historic mill that started in Tempe, Arizona. But our mill is not located there anymore. We restarted the mill. It had been out of business for a while. So in 2011, my dad and I restarted it. And we actually are now located on the farm, kind of on the outskirts of Phoenix, where we grow a lot of our wheat. So it's very cool that we're kind of this vertically integrated mill. We have the farmer growing the fields, you know, just out the door. And then this the seed cleaning operation right there next door to us, the mill. We have this beautiful Italian stone mill. It's still very artisanal. It's not a giant grain elevator that you might have, you know, seen in most states have these big mills. It's much, much smaller. And then it goes out the door right there. So it gets turned into pancake mixes, all these different kinds of flour, flour for chefs and restaurants and bakeries, as well as flour for, you know, grocery stores. And then, of course, our online store, people, home bakers can just order directly from us. So, yeah, it's a really fun place to work. It's a fun place to be. We used to offer tours. We don't do that anymore since COVID. But we loved showing people like where their flour came from and connecting them directly with the source of their grains and flour.
Emma, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains. She joined us today to talk about why she enjoys using unique flours and grains in her recipes. You can find one of those recipes at wpr.org/foodfriday. It is a chocolate-flecked farro or farro banana bread. Again, find that at wpr.org/foodfriday. Maybe make some over the weekend and you can drop it off at the studio for me on. And speaking of inspiration from wpr.org/foodfriday, check out a nearly endless supply of recipes. I just took a quick scroll to see some of the options. Here are some highlights: beet pickled deviled eggs, carrot ginger soup, scallion pancakes, Cambodian coconut corn, vegetable chow fun, green angel hair pasta with garlic butter, the smoothest, fluffiest hummus, and rosemary lemon shortcake. Getting kind of hungry, but that's a risk of Food Friday. Get some great cooking inspiration online at wpr.org/foodfriday. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, check out the latest efforts to boost financial literacy for teenagers here in Wisconsin and join the conversation. What did you learn about money as a teen? What did you wish you had learned? What lessons do you share with the next generation, maybe with your own kids? You can email ideas@wpr.org and then join the conversation. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup. This week, 1A looks at the challenges ahead at the border. What impact will the end of Title 42 have locally and nationally? That story and more today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Wisconsin's young voter turnout led the nation in last November's midterm elections. New data from the U.S. Census Bureau shows that nearly half of Wisconsin voters aged 18 to 24 cast a ballot. Some recent statewide elections have been decided by less than 30,000 votes, so that youth demographic has the potential to swing results one way or another. But what caused Wisconsin's massive youth turnout in November? What, if anything, are we doing differently than other states? Our guest today will help break it down for us. Amanjot Kaur is a freshman at UW-Madison. She's a co-lead intern with the Badgers Vote Initiative through the Morgridge Center for Public Service and an intern with the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. I talked to her earlier today. Amanjot, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, we've got this data showing Wisconsin youth voter turnout a high in November for sure. Looks like it was pretty high in April as well. Does that match up with what you saw in person on the UW-Madison campus?
Yes, we have had a surprising turnout, both in the midterms and also in our April 4th election, the general in the spring. We were just talking about this a few days ago. One of the co-directors of the Badgers Vote Coalition was sending us all of this data about how we had like 80% plus turnout during the midterm elections, which is very like historic for our campus. Usually we get somewhere closer to 75, 76. So we saw a bump from what we're used to, which was really amazing.
What is it, do you think, that's getting college students to turn out over this last couple of elections?
I think part of it is that we have, on this campus at least, made voting a lot easier for students, a lot more accessible. A lot more students are more knowledgeable on how the process of voting actually goes, like when to register and what IDs to bring. And also more people are becoming more and more aware of what's on the ballot, who their candidates are, what the issues are that people are passionate about. I think there have been a lot of important issues over the last few years that have really been bringing people out. I know in April 4th, for example, the Wisconsin Supreme Court election was really, really invigorating for students. And it got a lot of students to turn out because they were very passionate, regardless of which side they were on about a lot of issues like redistricting and abortion and the like that were going to be impacted by the Supreme Court. And I think in the fall, a lot of the turnout and excitement around the midterms was a lot of young people who are finally now able to vote, getting to vote in this really large election for these really large seats that have a lot of impact on their lives.
Now, it's been a day or two since I was college age, but back then there were initiatives to get younger people to vote, rock the vote and things like that. They didn't seem to work very well. Is there something you think about the current generation of new voters that is looking at the world differently than maybe the past couple generations?
That's an interesting question because I think a lot of our generation is very politically mobilized in a way that I'm not sure other generations or previous generation necessarily was. I think there's been so much happening in the United States politically and that people are very excited by what's going on and they have a lot of thoughts and opinions. And young people in particular have grown up through a lot of very turbulent things in the United States, like the recession in 2008 and the presidencies that have occurred during our lifetimes and like the COVID pandemic and everything that's followed COVID. I think that a lot of us are very aware of all of these different issues going on because we've kind of lived through the turbulence, and that's mobilized students in a way that maybe didn't exist for previous generations. I also think that a large difference for us is social media and the internet. I know in particular for Badger's Vote, this has been a really important tool, is that we have seen the most voter education effort success when we use social media and the internet. We get tens of thousands of views on some of our election videos, which is just shocking. And a lot of students learn about what is going on in their local areas and their local elections through our social media, through our Instagram, through our reels and our video postings and our collaborations with other social media people like Charlie Behrens, for example. A lot of those social media, like internet efforts, seem to really target students and younger generations well, because that's kind of what they're all on. They're all on their phones. So like having the ability to put that information where people are always putting their eyes towards makes it a lot easier to grab someone's attention and get them to care about voting and learn more about voting processes.
Now, if someone else is out there, either on another campus or in a community where they want to get younger people to vote, college students or non-college students, based on your experience with these elections over the last year or so, what would you suggest to them as starting points?
I think there are three things I would suggest. The first would be to make sure that the students and the young people in their area are educated on the voting process. I think a lot of people are intimidated as first-time voters. There's all these different steps you have to navigate. And I think voter education and civic education is a really large part of getting people to turn out to vote, helping them know when to register, helping them know what their voter ID is if you live in a state where voter IDs are a thing. Like in Wisconsin, for example, we have at UW-Madison campus a lot of out-of-state students that aren't used to their state offering same-day voter registration. So that's one of the things that we tell people and help them navigate, is how to register the day of the election. And voter IDs are also a thing that a lot of students aren't used to. So helping them navigate what is and is not a voter ID has also been a large part of our efforts to get people to vote. So voter education would probably be the first thing. The other thing that I would promote, or like the second thing, would probably be to listen and learn what it is that young people are passionate about. I've heard all sorts of issues throughout the year, and I think that learning what the candidates have to say on issues that young people really care about can really help them to understand why they should participate in an election. One of our other Badgers Vote interns, she went to a bunch of fraternities and sororities once to get students registered to vote. And she was talking about local elections, like the mayor and alderperson. And they were asking why they should care about older people. And she told them that they should care about older people because older people control their liquor licenses for all of the local bars and places that sell alcohol. So that got them mobilized to want to vote for older people. Knowing, I guess, the audience you're speaking to and what they care about can help get them more interested in why voting and elections matter.
Amanjot, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for inviting me to do this and for talking about these issues. I think they're super important.
Amanjot Kaur is co-lead intern with the Badgers Vote Initiative at UW-Madison and an intern with the League of Women Voters. She was with us today to share her experience as a UW-Madison student helping organize youth voting on campus. Wisconsin wasn't the only place that's seen a rise in youth voting in recent elections. The trend carried through in many states around the country, leading political organizers on all points of the spectrum to focus their efforts more specifically on the newest generation of voters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this record youth voter turnout? Did it surprise you? Why or why not? And are we talking about you? Are you one of the younger people who voted, maybe for the first time in November or April here in Wisconsin? Let us know what led you to the polls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Abby Kisa is the Deputy Director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University in Massachusetts. She researches youth civic and political engagement. Abby, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thank you so much.
How widespread are you seeing this increase of youth voter turnout in our recent elections?
Youth turnout has been historically high in recent elections. In the 2018 election, we saw young people vote at the highest rate in a midterm election since the early 70s, since the voting age was lowered. And it doubled compared to the 2014 election. And then in the 2020 presidential election, youth voter turnout jumped 10 points. And that really shows that young people are interested and will participate when they're given pathways to engagement. But there's still a lot of work to do to broaden the electorate. And one of the things that I think is really clear from this data is that young people's voter turnout is not a matter of apathy. It's a matter of access and opportunity. And so we really have to ask, are communities and institutions equitably preparing and engaging all young people to vote? And when you look across different states, we see huge differences. The census data that you were just talking about shows just dramatic differences between states. You know, over 20 point differences. And so as we continue to talk about this, we really have to think about it on a more local level and trying to understand what are the access and supports that young people have.
One thing I wonder about when it comes to different levels, how about young college students versus young non-college students? Do we see a gap there when it comes to turnout?
You know, this is one of the things that one of the things that the census data allows us to do is go back and look at trends over time, over the last 50 years. And this difference in education, the relationship between education and voter turnout, is something that has sustained across all of those decades for which we have this census data for 18 to 29 year olds. And one of the things that we think it comes down to is that young people who have experiences with higher education institutions are exposed to things like the Badgers Vote Coalition that the student Amanjot was just talking about. And they're exposed to people who are really actively involved in politics in some way and learning some of the skills that really lend themselves to participating. And so that matters a great deal. And one of the things that we've seen over time is that young people who are not on college campuses get a lot less support and a lot less attention, for example, from political campaigns, right? Political campaigns often just go to college campuses. And so this is one of the areas where communities have a lot to do to be more inclusive in how we think about elections.
Yeah, let's imagine a town or city without a big college campus on it. Do you have thoughts on what a community could do to say, hey, we've got a lot of young voters here. We'd love to see them participate. How do they open that door?
Absolutely. This is a great question. And I think it starts with young people in that community. And this is one of the core parts of what we call a sort of circle growing voters approach. Not only is it rooted in understanding and working with young people in a community, but it starts well before a young person reaches 18. Because by a young person reaching 18 years old, there's plenty of opportunity for that young person to develop, you know, a sense of the sense that politics isn't for them or that they're not welcome in it. And so by starting to reach young people before they reach 18, not only are we reaching them, you know, when many are still in the K-12 institute, K-12 school districts, but we're also reaching young people at a moment when they're building their sense for who they, you know, continuing to build their sense for who they are. And that's really when civic habits are forming, because voting is a habit. We call it a civic habit. And once a young person starts to vote, the more likely that they are to continue to vote. So two really core things about for a community is understanding that we have to start these conversations with young people before they reach 18. We have to include young people in a wide range of young people, not just the young people who are opting into the, you know, high school Republicans and high school Democrats. And we have to recognize that it might take a lot, many stakeholders to make sure that there aren't young people falling through the cracks. And what I mean by that is we have to have multiple pathways for young people to find out about how to participate in elections. And, you know, like Amanjot was just talking about, they were talking to sororities and fraternities as well as on social media. They had multiple strategies that they were using. And that's the same for an entire community. We need to be, you know, talking about this in schools. We need political campaigns to be thinking about it. Our election administrators have to be thinking about the wide diversity of young people. And there's lots that parents and families can do as well, just to talk about these issues and build the awareness about how to vote and that an election is coming.
Talking to Abby Kisa, civic engagement researcher at Tufts University, looking at a boost in youth voter turnout, young voter turnout in last November's elections here in Wisconsin. According to new census data, Wisconsin number one in the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about youth voting trends? What do you think is driving younger people to the polls? If we're talking about you, we would love to hear from you. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Abby Kisa, civic learning and engagement researcher at Tufts University, looking at Wisconsin's strong youth voter turnout last November. According to new census numbers, looks like it was high in April as well in the Supreme Court election. Looking at what we can expect from young voters in future elections, too, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. There's a perception anyway that younger voters tend to vote for Democrats in elections. Former Wisconsin Governor Republican Scott Walker is now president of the conservative youth organization Young America's Foundation. He did an interview with Fox News right after our April midterm elections about the impact of youth voters and the need, he says, for conservatives to do better.
We don't yet know the numbers by age, but we do know that Dane County, which is where the University of Wisconsin's flagship campus is at, about 50,000 students are enrolled there. Dane County cast more ballots in the race for the Supreme Court than the largest county in the state, Milwaukee County. And in Dane County, 82% of those votes went for the radical. And so unless we turn young people around, and it's not as simple as one campaign ad or some sort of a coalition, this is years of liberal indoctrination coming home to roost, and we've got to turn it around if we're going to win again.
Can you talk about the partisan lean, Abby, on youth voting? And it gets controversial how youth vote outreach happens, too.
Yeah, thanks for this question, Rob. I mean, one of the things that we really need to differentiate between is what happens nationally and what happens in various states and communities. Because, you know, while it is a national trend that young people are favoring Democrats and more liberal candidates, this isn't the case everywhere, and it hasn't always been this way. And so one of the things that we've seen, for example, is that in the 2016 election and the 2020 elections, there's actually a handful of states, six or seven states, where then candidate and you know, also President Trump won young voters in a handful of states. And so, you know, we really need to bring more nuance to these conversations about young people, or we do them a disservice by just sort of stereotyping them. And this, you know, matters for how political campaigns think about young people, because if you're in a community that, if you're in a community and thinking about young people, then have conversations with those young people instead of stereotyping them and assuming what they think. And so this is just exemplary, I think, of the need for campaigns to spend more time listening to and speaking with young people. And we've seen in our data that that can have a strong correlation to young people actually turning out when political campaigns are actually speaking with them and reaching out to them. Unfortunately, we've certainly seen Republican candidates and the Republican Party do that less with younger voters recently than the Democratic Party. And so that is one thing that, you know, has been consistent over the past several cycles.
Let's bring on a caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Yes, hi. Thanks so much for this topic. I've been kind of working on it for 30 years. I'm a UW Poli-Sci graduate, and on the information issue, I'm concerned about the lack of education on government in our schools. The last statistics, which is fairly recent, I know 19 states have no civics courses. I quote a 2005 poll that I did in one of my works that more students could quote the names of the Three Stooges than our three branches of government. The neo-Confederates have finally won about 5 years ago. They convinced a national poll that slavery had nothing to do with the war. So obviously there's the false information and populist information versus our educational system, and which I see, I understand perfectly about the local need for young people, but to my mind, our education systems are not doing enough.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Abby, your thoughts on civic and government education and Kay's concerns about misinformation as well.
Thank you so much for this question, Kay. This is an absolutely important area for us to think about. And I think it has a very local lens as well. Because one of the things that we've seen in our work is that, you know, in addition to the fact that opportunities to talk about elections and voting in a school context in nonpartisan ways, they're distributed really unequally amongst young people. So young people in AP classes are much more likely to have that opportunity, but young people who are on the regular track are less likely to. And young people who are on a different track than that are even less likely to. And so that's one of the things that I think we need to be talking about is how can we make sure that all young people in K-12 have the opportunity to talk about and learn about some of these basic workings of democracy. And for us, one of the things that we have been a part of, it's called the Educating for American Democracy Initiative, has really been focusing on some of the ways in which schools can support teachers and that teachers can really be a leader in these efforts locally. Because one of the things that we've seen is that teachers who have support are much more likely to use the research-based promising practices for teaching civic education, right? And we want teachers to embrace those research-based practices. And so this is a really big thing that communities can do to come and rally support for teachers to be able to do this work. So Kay really brings up an important point, and we need to think about equity and distribution of young people's exposure to this, as well as what can be done to support teachers and schools to be able to do this work.
Okay, thanks for that call. And Abby, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Abby Kisa, Deputy Director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University, where she researches youth, civic, and political engagement. She is with us today to talk about rising youth voter turnout in Wisconsin in particular and beyond. Earlier, we heard from UW-Madison freshman Amanjot Kaur about her work as an intern with the Badgers Vote Initiative and the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this big uptick in young people voting here in Wisconsin, especially Wisconsin, but elsewhere in the country. You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If you are a younger voter yourself, love to hear from you about what your first voting experience was like, what got you to the polls. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, it's college graduation season and high schools are close behind. What does the job market look like in Wisconsin for graduates at all levels? We'll take a look and you can join in with your questions and experiences. And the race for space started as a contest between countries. In the last couple decades, private businesses have taken center stage. Look behind the scenes of businesses racing for orbit. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.